it also forces you to take your ego, leave it at the front door of that competition, and have your peers judge your work. So it's one thing, you can work for clients and their horses are sound and they're happy, and you can really start to believe that you are God's gift to shoeing, because everybody's happy with you, you're doing great. Until you get to a group of your peers, especially with somebody as a judge who's far more advanced in that particular skill set, and all of a sudden you learn that it's like I said before, you start to learn what you didn't know before you got there.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Hitting Your Stride. It's the start of a new season for the podcast, and I hope you've been enjoying the fantastic summer weather while we've been on hiatus. But we're back now, and we have an amazing lineup scheduled for the upcoming episodes, and it starts with this one. Helping you hit your stride today is Brian Mullins, a farrier and fellow podcaster. He owns Mullins Farrier out of Hockley Valley, and his podcast, the Mullins Farrier Podcast, shines a light on that aspect of the equine world that sometimes gets overlooked. Brian got his taste of equine life early, first working at a horse barn as a self-professed, ambitious 12-year-old, and things blossomed from there. His story is fascinating as it takes him on a full circle journey that leads him back to the passion he found at that horse barn. And on the Mullins Farrier podcast, Brian gets to share his experiences and talk about the stories he and his peers trade amongst each other. And now he's here to share them and more with us. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride, Brian. And how's your summer been going?
It's been great. And thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, it's kind of fun. I love talking to fellow podcasters.
Yeah, ditto. Yeah, that's always fun. And the audio does tend to be better.
Awesome. All right. So let's start this off. Not many 12-year-olds choose a job as physically demanding and time consuming as working at a horse farm and stay with it for nearly 10 years. So is it fair to say that you found your path without really knowing it so early in life?
For sure. Yes. My dad wanted to be a farmer from when he was very young. So he attempted that and unfortunately had a couple of bad years back in the late 70s, just before I was born. And so he had to get out of it and get a normal job. So his circle of friends were farmers. So that's what I was surrounded with. So that 12-year-old me just biked up and down my country road that I lived on and just asked every farmer if they needed a hand. I just assumed that was the best job to have. So
that's cool.
That's where I went. And Harold McDonald, old McDonald, was the first person to accept my offer. Some young green kid who didn't really know much. I think our first job was moving bricks from one pile to another. and from there, it just carried on. So, wow. Yeah.
So whereabouts in this relationship with your employer, were you allowed to start handling horses? Like, was there a certain length of time, or did he just kind of throw you right into the deep end?
Oh, I was right into the deep end pretty early on.
Yeah.
Harold taught me a lot about horsemanship. There were a lot of fumbles and things that went wrong, but he was very patient with me. And I remember one of the things he said is, whatever you do, don't ever let go of the lead shank, especially because we were dealing with babies and yearlings. And I completely I completely kept up with that. And he, we had this one yearling that got the lead shank somehow wrapped around its neck, and I tried to, and then it started to run, and I tried to run as fast as it did, and do that. Yeah. And so Harold, after he picked me up off the ground, he said, you know, when they're doing that, you can let go. So yeah, many hard lessons were learned.
Wow. Well, you're definitely serious about keeping up with your work, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, for sure.
So who were the main influences on your work ethic? Did it come from your parents, or was Harold as much to that credit for that inner drive and ambition?
I think it mostly came from my parents. They have worked as hard as required my entire life. And I don't know. I guess you just emulate what you see. And mm-hmm. yeah, we were lower middle class or middle class, I guess. And they just, my dad was a firefighter full time. And then he had two other part-time jobs that he did as, and then my mom had several part-time jobs. Just set up so that she could be there when we got back from school and stuff like that. But yeah, they both worked crazy hours and all the time.
Yeah. So. And you know what, honestly, I think that's got to be a characteristic of any of us who work in the equine industry.
Yes.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, I think too, like I had the exact same example growing up. You know, my dad was self-employed, and, you know, my mom was a nurse for 40 years, and, you know, we had family hobbies that were involved. So like my work ethic was developed very early. And then horses being in my family, it was just like, wow, this is how you work. And for me, getting into the massage therapy at a time when it really didn't exist as a profession, and to build a business of it. But it's funny because as I'm getting older, I'm really flashing back to the development of my work ethic. And for me, as much as I love it, and I still do after 23 years, I'm like, I've got to learn how to find that other side of learning, like boundaries. And
exactly.
Isn't it challenging? How do you deal with that?
I don't know. I'm in the same boat, because when I started shoeing, I felt like I had come to it pretty late in life compared to most. I think I was 28 when I started chewing. So I just dove in headlong, and I would take on any horse. I would work until whatever time was required, and it was 7 days a week. And I've done that for years. And yes, I actually ran myself to burnout a few times. Wow. And it's just, as you would know, with something that physical, it's the same as what you do when you're doing something that physical, and you have to think, and you have to interact with people. Mm-hmm. There's so many aspects to it that if you don't give yourself time to fill your cup afterwards, eventually that cup runs dry. No matter how much you think you're a machine, you're not.
That's right. I learned a few years ago that I don't wear a superwoman's cape, and that I can't do it all. But yes, it's such a challenge, because you love what you do, but you really do need to just say whoa sometimes, and it's so hard. So what was the appeal of horses for you, and how did that turn into your calling?
It's funny. When I was working for Harold, I started reading The Man Who Listens to Horses by Monty Roberts, and that became a favorite book. And that was, in the beginning, that was my goal. I was going to be him. I was going to train horses, and that was what I was going to do. And life took me in other directions, and that eventually fell by the wayside. But there was just something so interesting about working with the horses, and Harold was teaching me all along, like, it's like a completely different language that you have to learn. And most of it is physical, right? Like body language and yeah, there were just, it was, I really like challenges and I get bored with just the same old thing. And horses never allow you to get bored. You will always think that you have them sussed out and then they will throw a wrench in that. So
yeah,
I think I think the challenge of them, and just they're so they're incredible in that they will work with you. Some will work against you, but yeah, just finding that match and being able to work alongside each other day in, day out. It's pretty incredible.
And I think the one thing is kind of like what you said there, they're so honest with us in every moment, whether or not it's how we perceive their honesty. It's our human, you know, placement upon, it's their human, our human way of thinking that I think changes our perspective of what they're trying to tell us.
Big time. Yeah.
You know, like they're resisting, but why are they resisting? So let's step back and let's figure that out. And my goodness, I mean, you're in a position all day, every day, in one of the most dangerous positions, right? Trying to literally get the horse to work with you. How have you been able to work with some of the tough ones?
That's been, that's always the challenge. And I think it's just, so Harold was a good horseman and that taught me a lot, but then I worked with Andy Virgit. I apprenticed with him for 5.5 years. I built my own business throughout that period, but he was very good at reading what a horse needed. Like there were some horses where you could kind of sort of fight back with them, and others you just had to sort of let them settle and feel more comfortable with you. And he had this uncanny ability to know which was which. Now he'd grown up around horses himself, so I think there's that experience. I don't know if you could ever life hack that. It's just, it's experience. It's time.
It's an inner knowing too. Like it's
just
reading people, reading other people's and the horses, their energy. And
sorry to interrupt. I think one thing is you really need, with them, you have to be constantly paying attention. And there are certain things that over time, like as a farrier, and I've asked several farriers this, there's this sound that their jaw makes just as they're about to bite your back when you're working on the peg at the front, dressing their feet or clenching.
Wow.
And one can be kind of messing around with your back, but you'll all of a sudden hear that noise and you know to duck. It's just, it becomes a sixth sense that, you know, okay, it's time to get out of the way.
Wow.
But things like that, I think over time, you just get a feel for it. You know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Now I'm going to, not that I'm ever in the position with them that you are, but
I
wonder what that sound is.
it becomes very, it's a really good sound to know, to recognize for sure.
Well, you said that all it took was one day of a ride along to show you being a farrier was what you wanted out of life. Tell us about that one day and the experiences that swayed you to make that commitment.
So when you sent me that question, I looked, or I thought about that day. I can't point to any specific instance. I think it was just, we went to a lot of different stops and it was kind of just a milk run day for Andy. It wasn't like we were at one stop and did a whole bunch of horses. He consulted on one that wasn't even a horse he normally did. It just had issues that the previous farrier couldn't address. And I think it was White Line. And I think it was just watching Andy's interaction with the clients and just seeing his knowledge being respected and trusted with them. And I thought, man, I would really like, this is like another challenge. This is something else that I think is going to take a while to figure out. And hey, this could be fun. So, and it was a whole other aspect of dealing with horses that I had never thought of.
Okay.
In the, like, working with Harold, we used to laugh after the farrier would leave. He was always kind of grumpy, and he would leave, and we were like, could you imagine how bad he smells when he gets home, and all kinds of stuff. It was never something I thought I would do as a career. Right. And now I'm actively seeking out that man's phone number because I'd like to call and apologize to him. He dealt with rank mares. We never picked out their feet, and they were bedded on straw. No wonder he smelled.
Right.
And yeah, we did not give him the best conditions to work in, which is probably why he wasn't always so happy.
It's such an important job, but I think, and we'll get to that in another question, but it's such an important job. And I think everybody looks forward to the farrier showing up. But yeah, it's kind of thankless in a way, which I don't understand, because I can stand there and watch you guys work all day, because it's mind blowing to me. But yeah, like I said, we'll get into that a little bit more in another,
sure.
Another question. So was it the whole, so basically that first day gave you a really nice overview of different elements of what the job would be?
Yes. And it's funny because I went back to work. I'd been at this trailer sales place for 5 years or over 5 years at the time. And I gave them a month's notice so that they wouldn't be left hanging. And I had, because I was taking on an apprenticeship position, I wasn't going to be making very much money. And it was only originally, I think it was only 2 days a week. So I needed something else to supplement my income. So I went back into sound engineering, like sound and lighting, which was something I'd done out of high school. And between the trailer job and the sound and lighting company, they both offered me jobs for more money than I'd ever made in my life, to work for them full time rather than become a farrier.
Wow.
And I turned that down because I just knew that I had to try this, and I was right. Like I would not have been happy in either other option.
It's so funny because was kind of my intro into this. I mean, I'd always wanted to be a lawyer since I was 8.
And really?
My grandfather, he was a Queen's Counsel, graduate of Osgoode out of Toronto. Like, it was just something that totally got me. And then, so I went and got my political science degree. And then I knew the people that started up the 2-year full-time program out of London for the massage therapy. So,
okay.
Yeah. Like, you know, do something. And plus family expectations on that whole lawyer thing.
No kidding.
That was a bit of a hurdle for my father to understand why I wanted to do this massage stuff with horses. But yeah, like, you know, choose this or go a completely unbeaten path for me at the time in the industry and make something of it. And it was just exactly like you. It's like, I know that I can do this and that I'm meant to be doing this. So yeah, it's something you can't ignore.
No, not at all. What do you think drew you to it over law?
Well, I think this is my theory. I think we're all drawn to horses because subconsciously we know that there's some healing that they can do for us.
Right.
Right. Like there's that. And there's just something about them. I mean, horse people are a complete enigma to begin with. I mean, you know, your average person is afraid of these, and yet we put ourselves on them, underneath them, you know, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, like I remember one time I was massaging away. It might've been 3 years after I started, and I just got this wave of energy. Like, I really hope the horse is getting as much out of this as I am. Like, it just felt like such an overwhelming gratitude that the horses allow me to do this for them. But yet in those moments of silence, when I'm working on their body and there's that exchange of energy, I know that I'm getting something as much out of it as they are. It's pretty crazy.
I completely understand that. I think a lot of farriers that I know, without that particular career and being able to work on them, I think many of us would be lost. Like, they're just good for the soul.
Brian, that gets me when you say that. It's so true. Well,
I mean, a lot of farriers are pretty, I know the word gets used way too much, but ADD, like it's a lot of energy. And if you don't have a place to direct it, and horses give us that and give us the challenge to keep us coming back. Wow. How many other careers could they do that would sustain them or sustain us? So,
wow. That's an amazing point there. That's a thinker for sure. Wow. Okay. So what do people, even those in the equine industry, really need to understand about farriers and what they contribute on a daily basis? I'm looking forward to this one.
Me too. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I feel like this is a really good opportunity to speak up for farriers in general. I have a lot of my former helpers call me with situations that they run into. And now, because of the podcast, I have just farriers all over the world that actually reach out for some reason to me, just to kind of ask like how I deal with certain situations and, or share stories just because they need to get it off their chest. So especially for the farriers who are working on backyard type horses, often they have more knowledge than the owner of the horse. Sometimes I think there needs to be like some kind of a licensing system. I mean, you need a license to drive a car, but you don't need a license to have this animal that is completely dependent on you. And you can be completely ignorant of what it needs. So sometimes the farrier, or not sometimes, often the farrier is the first line of defense and the first voice for the horse when something's really required. I have a lot of friends who tell me about times where they're like, this horse has laminitis. They come to trim it and it's standing on a newly cordoned off section of lawn, and the feet are hot, and they tell the owner, listen, this horse is sore and needs a vet, like, and you need to get it into that dirt paddock over there that doesn't have any grass. And so often they'll come back and the horse is still standing in the same paddock. The vet never came out. And they'll say, you know, he was kind of sore after he trimmed him last time. Like, do you think you trimmed him too short or something like that? Like, and that is so common. And I think it runs against human nature. Like, horse owners think, like, if you take that horse away from the grass that it loves and the treats that it loves and all of that and put it in a dirt paddock, well, you're just being cruel.
Yeah.
But you come to find out you're killing them with kindness going the alternate route. Yeah. So situations like that, I think, come up a lot. Another thing, I did a podcast with three other farrier-related podcasters. We did it all together so that all of our audiences would kind of be able to hear these stories. But so many farriers get hurt unnecessarily. And it's not just because the horse is being bad. It's because the environment that they're in while you're trying to shoe them is just unsafe. Mm-hmm. So I had an example the other day. I was working on a horse. He's a really good guy. I've been working on him for years, but his owners bought a new farm. And they had the landscapers there and the pond people there the same day. And the tree guy, the arborist, decided to cut a tree down in front of the barn door while I was shoeing him. So stuff like that, that the owners might not necessarily think of, that can get the farrier hurt, the horse hurt, even the owner hurt. Another thing that comes up quite common, and people call me to kind of share their experiences, is that they'll have a horse that is scared of them, scared of that whole situation, and the owner will not pay for a vet to come and sedate them. Like we are typically pretty tough, and we will try to get through most situations because we're all busy and it's tough to like call it, go home and wait for the vet to come and like schedule a time with you to come and sedate the horse and do what's required. And but if your farrier's saying, listen, this is what we need to do, they mean it. It's yeah. they've exhausted all their other options, and that's just to keep them safe, because so many, once we get injured, we're out.
Like, yeah, we can't afford to do that at all.
No. Now the incredible thing about the farrier community is we bond together. I know several situations where somebody's been injured, put out of the game for an extended period of time, and we all just pitch in, do the horses. The farrier who's injured basically invoices for the work, and that just keeps them going. Aww. But I mean, it's tough because it usually happens in the middle of the summer when everybody else is busy, and we have to add to it, but we're all each other's insurance policy.
I never really knew that part. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's a fairly common thing. I saw that right from the very beginning when I started apprenticing. Andy did it for somebody who'd injured his ankle. And yeah, it's just been a continuous thing. It's pretty incredible. I don't know many other trades. I actually heard a lawyer client of mine one time say, there's no way we would do that for another lawyer. We would just take their clients.
Gosh. So what have you learned about yourself by having chosen this profession? Like in just a few words, what do you think Brian Mullins has learned the most about himself?
I think how much I like challenge. And this is one of those careers where you can, the sky's the limit. There are so many aspects to it. You would never learn it all. And if somebody says that they have, they're probably not aware of how much more there is available. You don't know what you don't know. And I think this career really taught me that.
I love that because like I had the same thing. I mean, the moment that you think you know it all, my saying is you might as well pack up your toys and go home, because there's always something to learn. There's always that other client that can teach you something. There's always another pathology or something that you need to shoe that's completely different. And I've got to say something, this keeps popping up for me, and I mean no disrespect at all, but every time you see a farrier in the heat of the summer or the cold of the winter, they're tired, they're dirty, they're sweaty, they're like up to the elbows with, and you guys are so focused and stuff. And is it fair to say, and I like, again, I hate asking this question, but I think, do people look at you guys under the conditions that you work and see what you do? Because you just said there's always a new challenge every time. But do people really see that? Do they see that you guys are just, you know, cleaning out their feet and snip, snip and shave, shave and the nail on a shoe and you go? Like, is there some discrepancy with how people view the technicalities of your job?
Yeah, it's a very interesting trade in that I don't think there are many others. Like, I don't think electricians have the client looking over their shoulder saying, you know, I think I would have cut that wire shorter before I put that in there. And the more we learn and know, the more subtle the changes are going to be in what we do. It's incredible how, so I started this journey of going to Heartland Horseshoeing School at least once, usually twice a year. And at first I was learning a lot of forging stuff and some shoeing, but a lot of like making shoes. And at first you could crank out shoes all day long. Now when I go, I will work on one shoe for 2 days, and it's the intricacies of that shoe and getting those honed in that take so long. And it's funny because I'll see somebody who's just starting on that journey and they've got a pile of shoes stacked up beside them. I'm like, wow, what am I doing wrong? And it's just, yeah, you those little subtle things I couldn't even see before.
Right.
It's a really neat thing. Cody, one of my huge mentors, he always says, like, your eyes will, like, your hands will catch up to your eye, and then your eye will start to see the new thing that you need to accomplish. Like, you'll see the same demo that he does over and over again, and then all of a sudden you'll see something that you didn't see the last 7 or 8 times.
Wow.
And so you see it, and then you're like, okay, how can I recreate that? And then your hands eventually catch up, and then you start to see the next step that he's well ahead of you, and you have to continue on that process. So I think that's one of the really interesting things, is that, yes, some people, now you can't generalize, because yes, there are some farriers who just, they are just there to make feet shorter and put on some shoes and away they go. They don't pursue any more education or anything like that. I'll never see them at a clinic or whatever, but there are probably a majority of us that I'll see at so many clinics. I'll see them on online webinars, and they're constantly trying to learn more, and you will never notice it, because your horse will be sound, and that's the goal.
Yes. That's so true. That's what I find with the massaging. I've been working on horses for years, or if I start with a horse and I've got 4 or 5 massages in, and the owner will say, oh, you know, I think we're going to hold off with the massage. You know, the horse seems to be doing really well.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll see you in a couple months. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
All right. So during your trailer sales days, I love this, because this is a great life coaching kind of question. What did you find most challenging about going from a self-professed introvert to an extrovert? Being driven by a passion is one thing, but going headfirst into the deep end of the discomfort pool is something else entirely different. So how did you handle that?
Well, so sales they were never a passion for me. Yeah. It was just something I had sort of fallen into. They were family friends, and I just took the job on as like an interim career or job, not even a career. And then suddenly 5 years later, I was still there, still looking for that career. And it's kind of sink or swim. You in sales, if you don't learn to communicate with people, you're not going to do well. And I was paid like a regular salary, but then commission on the actual sales. So that was a huge motivator. It's amazing how being hungry can really push your boundaries and cause you to go out of your comfort zone.
Yes.
But the thing I learned is just asking people questions about themselves. That's the most comfortable thing they can talk about. And with trailers, it's such an emotional thing. I think even more so than cars for some reason. Like when people went to trade in a trailer, they always thought it was well worth more than it was. And maybe that is a thing with cars. I don't know. But there's just such attachment to it, because it's this, it's a hobby, but it's a hobby that they spend so much money and time dedicated to.
Yeah.
And without the trailer, they can't do it. I really learned to appreciate people, and those skills have transferred. Like, I love dealing with people now. Some people say, horse people are crazy. And yes, a lot of us are, but, farriers are kind of like the hairdressers of the horse world, and maybe massage therapists are too.
I don't know.
People will stand there while you're doing your job and then tell you the most intimate details of their lives, and I don't know, I find it very interesting. My other passion is human psychology now, and I think this job kind of encapsulates both.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure just like me, you've considered writing a book. I mean,
yeah. 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 But it could be considered a tell all, and that wouldn't be good, I guess, for business. I'll have to wait until I'm retired.
Oh my goodness. All right. So talk to us about relationships within the industry and how important they are when it comes to doing your job the best you can. So how much of being a good farrier is also being, like you mentioned, a good communicator and working well with the complete equine team of any given horse? And this is a really important question, I think, from not only our point of view as parts of the team, but for listeners to understand for the horse owners out there as to, it's vital that we all play a role and be that good at being communicators.
For sure. We apparently back in the day, vets and farriers were just arch enemies. They never communicated with each other. And I think that must have been to the detriment of the horse so often. And now both vets and farriers have grown into this concept of communicating between each other, because we actually find out we are working towards the same goal, or we should be. And massage therapists and the chiropractor and the grooms, you can't forget any of those aspects. I learn more from just a groom sort of just telling something off to the side while I'm working on a horse about the horse that I'm going to do next. And I'm like, wow, I wish I had known that, or I'm glad I know that now before I even start working on them. Yeah. And so Dr. Andrea Dubay, I have to do a big shout out to her. She has been incredible in teaching me the intricacies of communicating between vets. And I hope I've helped her in some ways too, because we'll call each other and say, okay, I'm dealing with this person. What's the best way to get this point across without being offensive? Because I think sometimes ego gets in the way, or it something you say or do becomes a slight without it being intended that way. Mm-hmm. And then that communication falls apart. So she will text me and tell me, okay, I injected this horse here, here, and here, just so you know, with any barn that I work on. And so many other vets now, we do that back and forth, or I'll say, I hoof test all the front feet that I do. It gives me kind of a heads up if something's coming up, but it also gives me a chance. I can then call the vet and say, hey, I found this. Do you think we should be doing this to kind of thwart an issue later on, rather than being reactive? Let's be proactive. And, mm-hmm. and maybe we can just avoid some downtime because the horse is lame on something that we could have prevented earlier. And we are so fortunate to work in the area that we do, where there are so many vets that are of that attitude. There are so many, I couldn't name them all, but I deal with so many who are so great that way. Like, we talk way more than clients, I think we do.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I've had phone calls and texts and emails about, hey, Trace, when you go out to see this horse next, you know, look in this area, this is mm-hmm. what I've done, that kind of thing. Or if I'm working on a horse that I've worked on for years, or I guess even otherwise, there are certain muscle habit development that I can feel that sort of lead me to thinking this might be going on. So I'm not diagnosing, but you might talk to your vet about looking into this, right?
Exactly. So,
yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, developing those relationships. So like, that's my goal. I like to work with a chiropractor and a farrier and a vet and any other, the additional bodywork treatments that are out there that, you know, can help put these horses in a better place. And to me, it doesn't matter whether they're jumping a 5-foot oxer or, you know, puddling around at the little shows on the weekends kind of thing, yeah. Right? It's all the same goal. And I think too, with what you said about why we do what we do, I think our joy and our passion in it is because, like, we're authentic. I mean, I can speak from it, and I've known you for a little bit. We've crossed paths here and there mm-hmm. over the years, and I'm always drawn to your openness Like, so to see, you're like, hey, good morning, you know, like you are very approachable. And I think when people can sense that about you, and like you said, when they're willing to share all those stories about their lives.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I get that the same thing too. And I'm like, wow, there must be something about me, but I love it. I love talking to the people. And yeah, there's definitely a little part-time psychology degree going on there
too. Yeah, very amateur psychology, but oh, yeah. I think it's there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so this whole farrier competition thing, this is, I find, and I've heard of them, but I've never known what's going on regarding them. So can you describe what a competition for farriers is like? Because I'm sure not many people can imagine what goes on in one. What does it do for you in your day-to-day work life? And how does that assist you with furthering your education?
So when I was apprenticing with Andy, I lived close by where I grew up, I lived close by to Doug Buck, and I had a day off with Andy. So I called up Doug and I said, hey, can I just hang out with you and your crew for the day and see if I can help out? So he took me along, and he was running a competition at the time at Leatherstone. And at the end of the day, he said, if you sign up to do this competition, I'll sign you up for free and I'll help you with the forging exercises. You just show up in my shop and I'll show you what you need to learn and work on. So I did that, and I met this whole group of farriers that were all about improving what they do. And it led me to going to the school, because I met Chris, the teacher there. He was a judge at a competition that I went to. And so a competition, typically you have different divisions. There's usually three divisions, like a novice, intermediate, and they call open, and with the skill level getting harder with each one. And you'll have each segment, you have to do say a pair of shoes, and there'll be shoes that have, like, as you get into the open category, there'll be shoes that are therapeutic in nature, but way more complicated, and there are so many elements to them that you have to be able to do and forge into them. But then you also have to do that within a time limit, and then have a judge look at them and decide whether or not you did it better than the other people in your category. Wow. So it's really interesting in that. So it forces you into the shop because you have to practice for it. It forces you to look at feet differently, especially when you're working on more of the therapeutic shoes. And then it also forces you to take your ego, leave it at the front door of that competition, and have your peers judge your work. So it's one thing, you can work for clients and their horses are sound and they're happy, and you can really start to believe that you are God's gift to shoeing, because everybody's happy with you, you're doing great, until you get to a group of your peers, especially with somebody as a judge who's far more advanced in that particular skill set, and all of a sudden you learn that it's like I said before, you start to learn what you didn't know before you got there, right? And what to look for. And then usually at the end, there's like the last class will be a live shoeing. So people will bring in horses and then you shoe a horse to a prescription. Oh, wow. And so in our modern day, thankfully, we have factory made shoes. They call them keg shoes. And we can go into the store and pick out what we need, all the sizes, everything else. All we have to do is shape them and put them on their feet. But I did not shape shoes as effectively or to the benefit of the horse until I learned through competition and going to the school and stuff like that, in a way that was going to benefit them. It just forces you to work on a skill that we're an unlicensed trade. You could set up shop tomorrow and call yourself a farrier. And you might get away with certain things for a while, but you're, and that is, I think, mostly due to the fact that a horse is pretty accommodating. Like, their anatomy is designed to accommodate a bad trim and poor shoeing, because out in nature, if they tear off part of their hoof wall, they still need to be able to carry on.
Yeah.
So I think it just competing, I only did it in the beginning and then took a different avenue for educating myself, but I think it was key in getting me to that avenue.
Okay.
And then the next step is certification.
Right.
So I can't remember. Was that part of this question or that's an answer?
Well, how you've talked about continuing education. So
right.
How is that going for you, and where are you headed in the future?
So I continue to go to the school. COVID really messed that up for a little while. So all I had were webinars and things like that. But now that we can go out and play together again, farriers were so hungry to get out and do clinics and stuff. It's been great. But so I go to the school and certification, most people aren't aware of this. Farriers will do it and it makes no difference to their business as far as a client's perception goes. Wow. But you have the American Farriers Association, you have the International Association of Professional Farriers in North America, and now a Canadian association, and they have created, I think, well, the AFA would be the oldest one, the American one, and it's a system where you have to go through basically a testing, and it's written, so you have to do your theory portion, you have to have a shoe board where you do these modifications to shoes, and then you have to shoe a horse to a prescription. And that might not be a prescription that you do every day, but it's just that prescription is dictated so that it doesn't matter what state you go to when they're hosting a certification, that you're going to get the same critique and the same judgment basically on your shoeing job, no matter who your examiner is. So that really changed my game, because then it forced me, I had to learn the books. Like, I read the books several times, but until you have to regurgitate all of that information onto a piece of paper or to an examiner asking you questions, that's when you really have to absorb that information. Yeah. And that made me so much more comfortable with talking with vets, because now I was learning their language. Mm-hmm. But as far as my clients were concerned, I remember, so CJF, and I've told this story before, and maybe it's because it's a sore spot, but a certified journeyman farrier was it's a pretty high mark in the American Farriers testing system. So I finally passed it and then got fired by two people. And it was because I was shoeing the horses differently, because I had learned that some of the stuff I was doing wasn't benefiting them. And I lost the accounts because I didn't leave a whole bunch of shoe sticking out that they could see that was shiny and looked like support. And it's just, it's a concept that had been going through the hunter jumper world, especially for such a long time, that I couldn't fight against it. Now, I picked up clients after that who trusted that I knew what I was doing. It didn't matter that I had my CJF, but it gave me confidence that I knew what I was doing. I'm not a fake it until you make it kind of person. I can't push that very well. If I don't believe in it, I'm not very good at pushing it. So,
wow. That's pretty incredible, because, you know, the drive for the knowledge and bettering yourself and bettering your profession is, I think, speaks to your success, because you are genuinely love what you do. And it's like that continuing education, you know, how many years have you been doing this?
it's been probably, I want to say 7 or 8 years of going to the school.
Right.
Almost two times a year.
Yeah.
And then actually it might be even longer. My concept of time is not great. But so then there was a testing system, an international testing system that Chris had come up with, the teacher at the school, and they use it in Brazil, Australia, and South Africa, all over the place. And the cool thing about it is your examiner comes from a different country.
Nice.
And you can take it in any of those countries as well. So I pursued that, and then that became a stepping stone to the be all end all, the British testing system. So in England, they have the Worshipful Company of Farriers, which is their main association. And there are two higher level exams. In England, you have to have an apprenticeship, you have to go through school, and you have to pass the diploma exam in order to be a farrier. It's completely regulated. If you shoe horses without that, they'll actually, you can be charged for it or fined. So they have the diploma that every farrier has to have, but then they have these two higher level exams, and they are the toughest. So that's my new path.
Nice.
And it's really cool because there are so many farriers that want to do that, and we end up working together. Like I have two friends, Andrew DeVisser and Sarah Vanderpoel, who we work together studying. We have Forge Days together, and it's just to, you know, prepare for this test.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's really fun.
I'm going to have to follow up with you and find out how this is going.
yeah, give me some time.
Okay. So let's talk about the Mullins Farrier podcast. This allows you to bring together your passions for working with the horses and for that sound engineering. What's been the best part of podcasting for you? And have you had any fun, eye-opening stories that you could share with us?
So yeah, the podcast has just opened up this whole world to me that I didn't expect. It started out as an idea that I actually shared with Andrea Dubay on a walk. And she said, you should do this. I think this is a great idea. So I started with a few farriers that I knew and that would actually do it with me. And then slowly progressed and gained momentum. And I wouldn't be able to do any of it without Heather McPherson. She's my marketing person. She would help me reach out to people. She edits the episodes and posts them online. And she is just as much, she's the wizard behind the curtain who makes it all happen. I now have friends all over the world. I could go almost anywhere and stay with a farrier and just hang out. I'm going to England in October because of the podcast to do a bunch of interviews for the British Farriers Association. Yeah, it's opened up all these opportunities. And my good friend who's a podcaster there, Daniel Bennett, and he's a teacher at the college, he and I are going to hang out and interview people together.
That is so exciting. Your yeah. Extrovert is like extroverted.
Yeah, opinion. Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's no looking back now. So, but yeah. And the most eye-opening part of it has been how many people personally reach out to me through Facebook Messenger or even the website and ask for advice, or I really on the podcast push the concept of certification. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of farriers, we get burnt out because we just work. You never know when you're going to lose that one account. So you take on the next one and work way more than you should. And the process of certification is such an antidote to that burnout. And it makes zero sense because you end up working, going home, forging and practicing, and then you go on a weekend, pay a bunch of money for somebody else to tell you you're shoeing wrong, and then you're happy to start up on Monday again and take what you learned and use it on the horses. Yeah. So I've had so many people reach out personally and just say, you know, this particular guest, they really inspired me. I'm going for my certification now. Or I was really burnt out, but this particular guest really inspired me. And now I'm going to ride along with a couple other farriers and learn some things.
That's awesome. So,
yeah. It's been the most fulfilling thing. I didn't realize it would be, but it has been.
That's sure. Great. So a little story along that line for me. So when I started this podcast along the line of the life coaching part of my world, you know, I wanted to have these kind of conversations that are meaningful, digging a little deeper, that kind of thing. And the first episode that Horse Sport, the Horse Media Group, put out for Hitting Your Stride was my episode with Christelotte Boylan. And, you know, and I don't know, a couple of days later after it had been out, I'm sitting in my car dealership waiting for my oil to get changed. And I get this email from this woman from Alberta who just wanted to let me know that the listening to that podcast changed her life, is what she put it, like her and her relationship with her coach and her horse. And I'm sitting there like, I hope nobody sees me, but I was getting all emotional.
Yep.
I'm like, this is why I'm doing the podcast. I hope that people can take little bits of these conversations and help guide them through the tough times, motivate them, like whatever it is they need. So I'm thoroughly with you on that one. And I just love this connection with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how... I don't know if this is the appropriate place to ask you this, but how does the life coaching portion of your career work now?
Yeah, no,
what are you up to?
Still massage. Thanks, Brian, for asking. It's still massaging like a crazy woman. I think I've had a record year, but yeah. So I got into the life coaching during COVID. I'm like, well, when the barns were shut down, I'm like, what can I do? And, you know, thinking eventually down the road, like, you know, when I can't massage anymore, and I've always been somebody that people like to talk to. I like to talk to people about, you know, and my life journey, my self discovery journey has been a broad one. So like there's experience there. And so, yeah, it's really neat. My focus is on the equine industry. That's my niche, but like I'm working with clients that, you know, outside of their horses, they want a new job. They're building a business. They want to find, you know, like a different purpose in their life. Like it's fascinating. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah. And it's very motivating and energizing for me. I love it.
No kidding. And I can see how the podcast would align perfectly with that.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't know if you would, from an outsider's point of view, I don't know if they would get that right off the bat, but then as you hear the conversations, yeah, it makes sense. You are inspiring people. So yeah.
I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So last question here. You find yourself in a lot of different people's orbits with your work, forging a very unique community to exist in. How would the 12-year-old ambitious Brian look at what you fostered and cultivated, and what do you think he'd say?
I can say that 12-year-old Brian had no clue that this is where everything was going to lead. Wow. That's for sure. I felt lost until I turned 28, as far as careers go, until I started doing this. And I mean, this convoluted path that I took, I didn't realize all of those things were leading me to it. Like the trailer sales, I learned how to communicate with people. Some people are great farriers, but if they're terrible communicators, they just don't get the clients because nobody really enjoys a visit from a grumpy person. I mean, some people might, and that is something I discovered through the podcast, is every one of us doesn't have a direct path to this. There, everybody has this really neat story that got them there.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at how different all of us started and then what we ended up doing. Wow. This common thread.
Okay, so what would you tell your 12-year-old self about what to expect next?
Oh, just keep paying attention, I think, is what I would. Yeah, I don't know what to expect next. Just a bunch of surprises. Just go with it. And as long as you keep your eyes open, and like you said, it being open to people and experiences, that's what gets you places. That there's so many opportunities if you're willing to keep your eyes open and look for them. And there you go. Like Andy, I sold him a horse trailer that had nothing in it so he could turn it into a farrier rig. And then we just had a conversation when he brought it in to get some work done on it. And next thing I had a job.
Wow.
So yeah, I think just being open to those opportunities really makes a difference.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess like in a way observing it. And then I always find too, like stepping back after you've been through something, whether, you know, feel really good or whether it's been a tougher time,
mm-hmm.
I think stepping back and observing it and reassessing it. Like, so what happened when, how were you feeling when, you know, Andy came in and bought that trailer from you the first time? Just like, there's never a coincidence with anything, but everything is always coincides.
Right.
I love that because, you know, our journey, we don't know what's ahead of us, but if we take the time to just take a look back and see how our life has unfolded, there's so much more meaning to it, I think. And it I find it very inspiring. Some of my tougher times, I can look back and go, holy crap, that was a doozy. How did I get through that one? And then I look now and I'm like, wow, it really helped shape me to who I am today.
For sure. And I think to allude back to what you were talking, not to allude back, to refer back to what you were talking about in the beginning, when you said, you know, you have that work ethic and you just go, go, go. And then learning to say, like, to set boundaries and say no, that comes from reflecting as well.
Yes.
And typically it takes an event, maybe physically you get hurt or mentally you're just like, I can't work today. Like I'm exhausted. I have to take a break. Your body will eventually force you into that self-reflection. if you're not willing to listen when it subtly asks, it will tell you eventually.
Yeah.
So and then that reflection, I think, helps you sort of reorganize. This world, the horse world in general, but I think the world as a whole, at least in the West, we're really focused on the hustle. Like when you ask somebody how they're doing, what's the first thing you say? Busy.
I'm so busy.
Yes. And if you aren't busy, you're supposed to say you're busy, because if you aren't busy, then there's something wrong with you. You're not.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So
doesn't make sense. We need to reframe all that.
Yeah. And horses definitely do make it more difficult. You can't, like, we all have run into those people who we meet maybe once or twice and then they get out because they're expecting a 9-to-5 with a 1-hour lunch break. And this world is not that, but at the same time, we do have to know when to, you know, fill our cup in other ways, which is really cool what you're doing now with the life coach. I bet you that it gives you a balance, right? That you're able to work on that other fulfilling thing, helping other people out.
Yeah. I mean, it between the coaching, the clients, and this podcast, it's definitely added two significant other aspects to my plate. But I love it. Like, it's energizing. And, you know, I'd like to know that I'm helping people. So yeah.
Well, you definitely are. How many people ask you, like, approach you and say, hey, I'm thinking about starting a podcast?
Not a lot. I mean,
I get it all the time.
Do you?
And yes. And I think they think that it's, first of all, they think it's easy. And second of all, they think that it's going to make them money.
Right.
I'm running at a deficit as far as this particular project goes. Yes. Right. And, but those messages, as soon as you get that message that you got sitting in that waiting for your oil change, that's what makes it worthwhile. Yeah. Like you can't put money on that.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of people ask me, and I usually send them Heather's way to kind of, so she can explain all that's involved. And then I don't think I know of too many that carried on with the project.
Yeah. Like this is definitely, you know, like you said, that there's a deficit here as well, but I don't do it for the money. That's
no.
I do it because I love it, because I feel like there's a purpose behind this, and and just having conversations with people like you. Like I said, we've crossed paths, you know, off and on over the years, but sitting here and chatting with you, there's a whole new connection.
Yep, for sure.
Right. So
yep.
I hope the listeners get a whole bunch out of this, because I know there's a whole bunch in it. So this has been awesome, Brian. Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing it. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
All right.
Great. Well, and great questions.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you like them. I will keep you posted. And hopefully we'll see each other soon.
Okay. Sounds good. Take care.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.